This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by Go Engineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit the UAVDigest.com/GoEngineer. You're listening to episode 304 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Fort Washington, Pennsylvania. Hello, Max. You've had a busy couple of days, haven't you?
I certainly have. I went back up into Maine and saw the Collings Foundation Wings of Freedom Tour, which if you're not familiar with that, the Collings Foundation maintains a fleet of warbirds, and they visit many, many cities. In fact, over 50 stops during the year, David. I was surprised that there were so many, but we got to see a B-17, a B-24, a B-25, a P-40, and a P-51 Mustang. It was a wonderful, wonderful day.
I recommend anybody, if you find out that they're coming to your local airport, definitely spend some time with old school aviation. But we're not here to talk about old school aviation. We're here to talk about new school, like Boeing's refueling drone making its first flight, micro turbine propulsion systems, solar drone propulsion systems, counter drone technology at our UN General Assembly, and some other stories, as well as a video a week from one of our listeners. So let's get started, Max.
All right, David, let's get started.
Well, our first story comes from UASmagazine.com. Boeing shows capability of an unmanned aircraft refueler. Finally, the MQ-25 unmanned aerial refueler first flew. This is actually the production version of the aircraft that was awarded the contract to be the Navy's carrier-based air refueler. Hopefully this Boeing tanker will go a lot better than the other Boeing tanker currently in production.
Yes, better than the manned version, the MQ-25. So this is actually a test asset, they call it. It's known as T-1, and it's owned by Boeing. And they flew several autonomous taxi and takeoff sessions. Then it flew in a predetermined route. Boeing test pilots, of course, were on hand. They were directing the flight from a ground control station.
And of course, this aircraft is being produced not in Seattle, but in St. Louis at the old McDonnell Douglas plant. So they flew from St. Louis Airport, which is a pretty busy airport. They did all of the basic flight functions. If you watch the video, you'll see it bank and left, right. And keep in mind that this is a flying wing. There are no vertical control surfaces. And it's the preliminaries. Eventually, they're going to build on to other aircraft. And eventually, it'll probably go to Pax River. Keep in mind that this is going to be a carrier-based aircraft that'll be catapult-launched and recovered aboard the deck of aircraft carriers, and completely autonomous to refuel the manned aircraft like the F-18 Super Hornets and the E-2D Hawkeye. So it's to be able to have the aircraft in the Navy return to attack aircraft. Right now, they have to designate at least two aircraft per squadron of the Super Hornets to fly aerial refueling. So you lose those assets for combat. So this will be taking that over. Originally, it was supposed to be the unmanned aerial combat aircraft, but that role has been reduced. So it's no longer a strike aircraft, just strictly aerial refueling and possibly reconnaissance. But we'll keep an eye on this. Hopefully Boeing's track record with this tanker will be better than it is with the KC-46 Pegasus. So, and the M225s are 2 years out. So we've got some time for development.
And I guess between now and then, Boeing is going to deliver some engineering development models, they call them EDMs, four of those before actual deliveries of the aircraft. So when they call this a test asset, I guess what they're saying is that, David, that it's a real preliminary kind of design just to get some baseline, some early data from the aircraft, and more of that to come with these EDM aircraft, the four that Boeing will deliver.
Yeah, I mean, it didn't have its tanker drogue or its additional fuel tanks, or it's strictly basically an aerodynamic test aircraft. So the EDMs will move on, and I'm sure they'll get more and more stuff hung on it and more sophisticated as we go on. So the next story isn't a fuel cell story, but I thought our engineer on engines would like it. And this is from dronelife.com. UAS Turbines unveils micro turbine propulsion system for drones. So what makes this special, Max?
Well, when you talk about mid-size drones, most of them these days are powered by some type of gas engine, a piston engine, and they tend to be noisy. A lot of them are two strokes, don't have quite as much power as you might like. So what we have here from UAV Turbines is it's basically a turboprop, but it's got a very tiny turbine, one that generates about 20 horsepower. And because this thing is so small, and because the engine, and because it spins at such a high speed, the sound that it does make is very high frequency. And as you may know, high frequencies don't travel as far as well, or don't penetrate the way low frequencies do. So for that reason, it's quieter. Even though it's using a turbine, it's quieter than alternatives that are piston powered. And they also expect this to be more reliable, easier to maintain. They call this a micro turbine propulsion system. And it's a little bit different than current designs. And of course, this is not something for your DJI Phantom, but something for kind of a mid-sized sort of drone.
Something along the lines of a Predator or a Reaper or some of the large scale delivery drones. So it'll be interesting though, Max, to see if they can start moving this to, turbines, now that I start my new job and I have to look at helicopters all day long, turbines eventually moved from reciprocal engines to turbines and helicopters for rotorcraft. So it'll be interesting to see if, being that these are so small, if they can convert them over to vertical takeoff and landing aircraft, or a combination of both because of the additional power. So, but right now it is strictly for a fixed wing aircraft. It's interesting though that I wonder how high the whine is when you're up close to the aircraft, so you have to work around these things when they're running. It's interesting that over a long haul, it's not as noisy, but it might be much more noisy as you're working around it on the ground.
Close up, yes. There is a video of this, and we'll put it in the show notes, but it's always hard to tell just how noisy or how loud something is from a video, because you don't really know how they've set the volume of the video. But at least in the video, as it's flying away in the sort of middle distance, it does seem quieter, but again, we don't know what volume levels they've set for the video. But it does give you an idea of this, and that'll be right in the show notes.
Well, let's go from gasoline turbines to, how about solar energy? The solar drone makes a historic flight. AeroVironment announced the successful first flight of the Hawk 30 Solar HAPS UAS, which, of course, HAPS being high altitude pseudo satellite or persistent satellite, depending upon which word you want to use. I prefer pseudo, but vocabularies change over time. So this is occurred on September 11th of this year at Armstrong Flight Center from NASA. Pretty big aircraft, though, with lots of solar cells.
Right. A 260-foot, roughly, wingspan. It's got 10 electric motors along the wings there. And, of course, solar panels cover the surface of the wings. But it is high altitude because, as a pseudo-satellite, the applications envisioned are for telecommunications, internet connectivity, that kind of thing. So this flies at an altitude of around 65,000 feet. And it's really designed to stay up there for months on end.
And of course, the reason why the wing's so big is because that's where all the solar cells are. They're laminated on top of the wing. It's going to be interesting to see what comes of this. AeroVironment and SoftBank Corp formed the HAPS Mobile joint venture. We'll have a link to that in the show notes. So check this out. It's kind of an interesting aircraft. Lots of little propellers and a very long wing. And they didn't really say anything about payload. So I don't know if it's going to be bigger or, and this is like what we just were talking about with the MQ-25, that this is just a preliminary, let's make sure it flies and is able to meet the standards before we load it up with electronics.
And this is something that that AeroVironment's been working on for a long time. Remember the Helios prototype that reached an altitude of over 96,000 feet, and that was way back in the year 2001. There was also that Pathfinder Plus prototype. And like I say, AeroVironment has been, and others have been working on this concept for an awful long time. So we have a flight here. I don't know, David, I can't recall the last time I ever heard a report of a first flight where there were lots of problems and it was a disaster and they were going to have to go back and and redesign it. It seems like all first flights seem to be successful, but in any event, that's what they're saying about this one.
Didn't the A380 have a problem on its first flight? Why am I remembering that?
Oh, now you're taxing my memory, David.
Well, you know, there are, I don't know, maybe that was a long time ago, but it was. Seems, but you know, there are aircraft that have had bred first flights, or more to the point, there are aircraft that have had zero flights. It's amazing how many high-speed taxi runs suddenly become first flights, you know, even though it's not supposed to be the first flight, right? Like the Spruce Goose, yes, or the F-16. So, but yes, you're right. As a general rule, the aircrafts tend to be right on their first flight. So, well, this week here in the United States, in New York, we've had the new United Nations General Assembly. And interestingly enough, the United States Secret Service has been using drones to monitor the General Assembly and all of the figureheads that have arrived from across the globe.
They've been piloting some counter UAS technology, C-UAS. And I mean, that's not really unexpected. In fact, they've done that. The Secret Service has used some of these technologies in the past. But I think this is maybe the first time that they've been doing this in an urban environment. So they want to see how well that works. But they're using technologies like RF detection, radio frequency detection, radar imagery, as well as electro-optical infrared cameras. And the Secret Service wants to use these technologies to identify objects that are flying in this area and to differentiate drones from other things like birds and as they say, flying debris, which I guess is maybe another type of airborne object in New York City.
Well, yeah, either that or I know a lot of people in New York City that would call the pigeons airborne debris or flying debris. But what you know, it's a very closed off airspace during this time. In fact, a TFR, or temporary flight restraint order, is in place for 2 miles around with the UN building on the east side of Manhattan. Being the center, what's interesting is monitoring all the aircraft, you can also see all of the tankers and the combat aircraft patrols that orbit over the city at the time, like F-15s and F-16s and KC-10s and KC-135s to support them. So it's a very very detailed flight zone. We'll see if there's any results that come out of this testing, if they announce it, or it will go away only to be, we won't know until it gets used again. So
yeah, it is the Secret Service, so they may not tell us what they find. But it has some similarities to, I think it was the Super Bowl, where there was some interagency cooperation, because they note that if using any of these technologies, the Secret Service detects a drone inside this area. They're not using any of this to take the drone down. What they do is dispatch the local police to go and attempt to locate the operator and then have a little conversation with that. Also, though, because they're doing this surveillance, maybe they're trying to head off some concerns about privacy and so forth. But they note that the cameras, electro-optical infrared cameras, will only activate when those sensors detect something, so they're not continuously scanning. Also, that all the imagery is captured in real time, but they're not storing the imagery, they say. And as for the drone or FAA registration numbers associated with drones, the Secret Service says they won't trace them, but they will share that information with local police for investigation when that's necessary. And the Secret Service has also, I think, wisely placed some signage at some local drone parks that warn of this TFR, and note that the police will occasionally be out there patrolling those areas to make sure that this ban is enforced. So I think that's good, to try to communicate with the community in advance, so at least most people will know what the restrictions are.
We now have the sequel to Speed, enforced by aircraft. Drones enforced by ground. Yeah. Well, if observation doesn't account, we could talk about what the Air Force is developing, which is intelligent air. This is from intelligentaerospace.com. The Air Force has contracted Raytheon to deliver a prototype high-powered microwave system. Yeah, this is not your kitchen's microwave, is it?
No, it certainly isn't. That high-powered microwave, HPM system. And this is something that troops would use to destroy hostile drones. Raytheon also has a separate contract from the Air Force to develop prototypes of a high-energy laser system, or HEL. So you got HPM and HEL. And there is a video, and we'll put this in the show notes too, it's a Raytheon video, and they're using these systems to take down drones. In the video, they're taking down what looks like a DJI Phantom, which is probably smaller than the targets they ultimately are hoping to stop, I guess. But, you know, this Phantom, David, I mean, it almost literally melts as it's flying in the air and drops to the ground.
Yeah, and the thing about the HPM system is it's a wide area beam, so you can take out multiple aircraft or swarms of drones, which is one of the next steps. You know, to use the mantra about the Area 51 run, they can't get us all if you send enough of them. But in this case, they're building first and second levels of counter UAS systems. So, like I said, this year was the year of counter UAS, you know, and we'll start seeing now what the next step is to counter the counter UASs. So,
and these are not man portable devices for taking down drones. I wasn't sure exactly what the size of these units was, but when you look at the video, you can see that these things are large. I mean, this thing is sitting on a flatbed. There's a whole control room for the personnel who are you know, operating this equipment. And it's a large, you know, at least it, in its current state. And maybe there's plans to miniaturize some of this, maybe. But as it is now, this is a pretty beefy piece of equipment. It's pretty large. And in one sequence of the video there, where they're sort of scanning the camera past the trailer with all this equipment on it, there's one little section that if you look carefully, it's pixelated out. And it goes by so quickly that I had to back up the video and to see if it was what I thought I saw. And it was. So there's at least some portion of this, David, that they've decided is sensitive enough.
Classified.
So it's actually pixelated out. So we'll have that video in the show notes and you can see if you can find the pixels.
But let's talk about some better news or interesting news. I still find it fascinating that we're talking about drones and weather, or more to the point, drones and tornadoes. But in this case, this is from earthsky.org. Boise State Dust Devil collaboration has been flying drones through dust devils. Now, if you don't know what a dust devil is, it's sort of a mini tornado that occurs out west, or like a water spout that occurs in the ocean. But here we're flying drones into them to figure out how to handle flight on Mars.
Dust devils occur on the Earth, obviously, in sandy or dusty locations. But it seems that they occur with great frequency on Mars. And they've been observed by some of the landers that we have, or the rovers, rather, that we have on the ground, and as well as by orbiting spacecraft around Mars. And the reason the dust is an issue is that the dust ends up covering the solar panels of rovers, and that lessens their efficiency, but it also can create a static charge, which is hazardous to electrical equipment. But kind of the interesting thing is, while we have models for lots of different kinds of weather objects, it turns out that we don't really have dust devils figured out too well. I mean, there are models that predict the behavior, but when you run the model and compare it to the real world dust devil behavior, there's a big gap. They don't match. So in order to better understand the dust devils on Mars, we're starting out with the ones that we have here on Earth and using drones to help understand the physics of what's happening with a dust devil.
And it was a Mavic 2 in May 2019. The collaboration says, quote, "The devil's high winds carry the drone along at first. The pressure dip at the center of the devil tricked the drone into thinking it was higher altitude, so the drone automatically dove down to maintain what it thought was a constant attitude. I chased after the devil but couldn't catch it. However, the lovely swirling curtains of dust are clearly visible in the devil's wake." This is kind of one of those unexpected events. I mean, it's a really, these aircraft are designed that they're supposed to, you program them and they're supposed to fly at X altitude, and X altitude has X pressure. Well, and if you know anything about hurricanes or tornadoes or dust devils, the pressures in the center go down. So the drone thought it was flying higher, so it went down deeper into the dust devil. It's an interesting one of those learning curves that you probably wouldn't think of before you were flying in it.
Yeah, that was kind of fascinating. In these drones, they carry cameras, of course, as well as pressure sensors and temperature loggers, and all this is to measure the structures of the dust devils. And they also take particle samples, which I thought that was kind of interesting. I don't know how the drones collect samples of the dust particles that make up the dust devils, but that's kind of an interesting aspect to this as well. It's pretty cool stuff.
Probably sticky tape like they did at NASA for comet samples. You know, if you go to the Smithsonian, they have the highly lightweight, very, very ultra sticky material that they use to capture comet particles. So it just, when one of the satellites flew through the atmosphere of the comet, they deployed this little bit of sticky mass and sure enough, the particle stuck. So it's a good way to tell where the dust devils come from, or where it started to come from, or, you know, air, dust and dirt and all of that stuff is carried aloft, but you can see how far the stuff has traveled, you know. Or if you remember seeing tornado, you can use the words cow, you know. So,
yeah, I guess. Oh, that's terrible.
I don't think a Mavic 2 could pick up the cow when it's caught in the dust devil, but that's a little humor. But we did get a video a week from one of our listeners, Gareth, from Down Under. Hi, Max and David. Here in Australia, our magpies start swooping at this time of year to protect their nests. Usually this is captured on a GoPro mounted on a motorbike or a push bike. Now magpies have another thing to worry about, drones. This magpie has taken a dislike to a particular drone. So this is our when magpies attack video. Yes. For the week. It's pretty humorous.
It's a short video too, but I don't think we have magpies around here, David. Do you have magpies?
Not that I'm aware of. I always equate magpies to England for some reason. I don't know why, but they're a type of crow. I mean, we do have ravens and crows, so.
But I thought just watching the magpie fly in this video was kind of interesting. Just the, I guess, black and white, the different colors on it, and how, I don't know, just the bird flying from that perspective just seemed kind of interesting. But yeah, this thing is clearly irritated by the drone and is, you know, following its instincts and is trying to scare it off. I don't know how long the operator of the drone stuck around near the magpie, but hopefully not too long.
Yeah, well, we don't want to disturb the magpies too much, so.
Right.
But again, thank you from Gareth. And if you, like Gareth, want to send us something, you can do that by sending us a link to the video or the video itself to feedback@theuavdigest.com, and maybe your video will be the video of the week.
That's right.
So I guess, Max, with that, we should probably wrap this up. What do you think?
Yes, it's time to wrap it up. I want to thank all of you for listening to episode 304 of the UAV Digest. You can find us on our webpage, theuavdigest.com. And if you want a link that goes straight to the show notes for this episode, that's theuavdigest.com/304.
And of course, you can find us on Twitter @UAVDigest, on Facebook @facebook.com/UAVDigest. We want you to become part of our conversations all week long and our Slack listener team. And you can do that by sending us an email with your email address to feedback@theuavdigest.com. And you can also purchase some swag at our Cafe Press store. If you listen to us on your podcatcher, please subscribe and leave a comment so that people can find us in a review. We really appreciate when people do that. So I guess with that, Max, I'm going to wrap it up and say, this is David in Fort Washington.
And Max in Hartford.
Thank you for listening.